And our special guest, Daniel Ellsberg, his book, The Doomsday Machine. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Daniel Ellsberg with us, his book, The Doomsday Machine. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Daniel, could you describe for us the effects of an atomic bomb when it goes off?
Well, the atomic bomb, the fission bomb, U-235 or plutonium, the early ones had an explosive yield 1,000 times more powerful than the largest blockbusters of World War II, 10 or 20 ton high explosive bombs, which were called blockbusters. I remember well when I was a kid in World War II, because they would destroy a whole block of buildings. So the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs were 1,000 times more powerful than that in explosive yield. They also generated heat, radioactivity, and fallout from dirt, earth that would be sucked up into the cloud, coated with radioactivity, and would eventually come down. And if people, they would die or suffer greatly from radioactivity. A thing that I would like to emphasize, though, is this, that that bomb, the use of which killed perhaps over a matter of months because of the injuries and the radioactivity and whatnot, more than they killed right away, but perhaps a total of between 200,000 and 300,000 people. But that was still on the scale of the killing that we were doing, as in Tokyo, where we killed 80 to 120,000 people in one night by incendiaries. So the Hiroshima bomb and the Nagasaki bomb didn't seem to change the scale of killing so much. Of course, they made it quicker. And it took 300 bombers to do that in Tokyo. You did it with one bomber in Hiroshima and another one in Nagasaki. The reason I'm emphasizing that is something changed in 1954 when we first exploded a thermonuclear bomb. And very few Americans I've found now know the difference between an A bomb, an atomic fission bomb, like, and an H bomb, a thermonuclear.
Most of us all think it's the same thing.
No, and the right now, of the 9 nuclear states, 6 of them have, including Israel apparently, have thermonuclear weapons, H bombs. 3, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, still have only the A bombs. But the difference I was just about to say was that in 1954, we exploded the first droppable H-bomb, thermonuclear bomb, which was 1,000 times more powerful than the Nagasaki bomb, or I should say than the Hiroshima bomb, 15 million tons equivalent of TNT, a million times more than the blockbusters. And a way to convey that is that every thermonuclear weapon, which is the great majority of our weapons now, of our thousands of nuclear weapons that we still have after reductions, use an A bomb, a Nagasaki type bomb, for the trigger, for a detonator, to set it off. And so it is a very big change. And at that point, the number of people that we anticipated killing, I found when I was working in the Pentagon on war plans, suddenly from 54, 55, 56, it changed from World War II-like figures of 10 million, 15 million, 20 million, very large, but still less than the 60 million killed in World War II altogether. Suddenly, from our own attacks, we were looking at hundreds of millions. And as you know, in the first pages of my book, I give an estimate given to the President Kennedy in answer to a question that I drafted for Kennedy. And so I was shown the answer because I drafted. The question was, if our war plans are carried out as you plan, you know, without failing, if they achieve what they're meant to achieve, how many people will be killed? And the answer from the Joint Chiefs of Staff was 600 million, or 100 Holocausts. Now, I had come into this problem in 58, having gotten out of the Marines in 57, with high respect for the military. I'd been a company commander. I was very proud of that. I was just a first lieutenant. And I had great respect for the military, and that's why I went into consulting for the military at the RAND Corporation. But to see this, that we were planning on our, and moreover, I should say, I accepted then, and I accept now even, the concept of deterrence, in the sense that in a world of warring states that we still have, so long as that is the way the world disorder occurs, that it's very understandable that a country with a rival that has nuclear weapons should not want that adversary or rival to have a monopoly, and that they should have some ability to retaliate, the capability to retaliate. I accepted that, and accepted that now. But to have a capability that was estimated to cause 600 million deaths at a time when the world population was 3 billion, by the way, was astonishing. And that they really were ready to do that. The reality, which we didn't know then, was this, and I've been alluding to it earlier, and I just want to spell it out for a second. The reality was that the firestorms, like that of Tokyo, which it took 300 bombers to achieve, a special kind of fire called a firestorm, which killed 100,000 people then. Nuclear weapons cause firestorms pretty reliably. And the firestorm lofts smoke and a very strong updraft through the troposphere, through our atmosphere, into the stratosphere, where it doesn't rain out. And where it goes, that smoke, by the tens and hundreds of millions of tons in a large war of smoke and soot, surrounds the globe and creates and obstructs some 70% of the sunlight, which would cause ice age conditions, permanent winter all year round on the earth below, but above all, would kill all harvests and vegetation mostly, and would lead to starvation of nearly all humans. Some small fragment in the southern hemisphere that might be eating fish or mollusks, but 98-99% near extinction would be the result of that large war. That's been true ever since. And the notion that any nation needs or has any justification, and that's us or Russia, or for that matter, India and Pakistan, needs to be able to cause that kind of famine, killing billions of people and near extinction, is, as I said earlier, morally absurd. It has no national security justification. It should end. And this country and the rest of the world has been pretty much in denial of the reality that what we have here is a Dr. Strangelove type doomsday machine, and that should not exist. And it's not justified by the fact that someone else has one. It should not exist in either place. It should go down mutually or unilaterally. There's no need for that, for deterrence or for any other need. And that is what we are rebuilding, and we should not be.
And what's so bizarre, Daniel, is there's so much hatred on this planet. I don't get why they just can't get along. You know, and build a planet and make it work, well, because we can, you know, make it work.
Look, why Russia, which is not, why Russia is regarded under Stalin as an enemy was very plausible. The notion when I went into the Rand Corporation, the Defense Department, was that what we were facing was Hitler with nuclear weapons.
Right.
It was a very, very daunting prospect. And Hitler did exist. You say, why can't we get along? Well, you couldn't get along with Hitler. That was true. And in fact, it was right even to ally ourselves with a tyrannous Soviet Union at that time against Hitler. Soviet Union was, in effect, a lesser evil. And it was the main agent, really, of defeating Hitler on a large scale. But the notion that Stalin was as reckless and aggressive and expansive as Hitler and constituted the same threat that Hitler would have had if he'd had the ability to have nuclear weapons, that's false. And basically, our intelligence people knew it was false. It was a way of selling a lot of airplanes and missiles to our government, paid for with taxpayer money or debt or whatever, and to our allies, like the Germans. Right now, for example, there's a military-industrial complex in Russia as well, which profits. They're capitalists now. So they make profits just the way Boeing and Lockheed and others, which are competing to build new, better ICBMs, which have been intercontinental ballistic missiles, land-based, which have been anachronistic since we had sub-launch missiles and since the Soviets had sub-launch missiles half a century ago. The land-based missiles are vulnerable. You use them or lose them. And in the case of a false alarm like that in Hawaii, or like much more dangerous ones that have occurred actually at the highest levels, the instinct on either side to launch those weapons before they're destroyed and to launch them against the other side's ICBMs is very strong. And that means that we're all hostages to a mistake half a world away, or a mistake in our own country. And that those million people who were scared by a false alarm in Hawaii a few weeks ago.
Yeah. And Japan. Japan had a scare,
yeah,
too.
And in Japan, right. I think it was 2 weeks later, a similar alert in Japan. And had that been at the highest levels, instead of just at the civilian heroes of that, we might not be here now, right now. It's absurd for the entire world to be, absurd seems such a weak word, you know, even crime, immoral. Our language is not adequate to deal with what we're facing here. As a matter of fact, a point that occurred to me just yesterday, I've been a particular comparison, trying to compare for 40 years here now with difficulty, and the following. How do you compare actually killing 6 million people, which is virtually the definition of evil in our world since Hitler, since the Holocaust? And of course, he killed many more than killed 5 million non-Jews civilians. Mm-hmm. Altogether, there were 60 million killed in the war. How do you compare the evil, the undoubted evil, unequivocal evil, of starting that and actually doing it to preparing to kill 600 million people or 6 billion people? Now, that's just a threat. It's to support the credibility of that threat, whether it's in a first strike, as usually, to prevent we build weapons and we deploy them and we train people to carry them out unquestioningly, you know, all of which creates a real risk that it will actually go off. And it's true right now, and I say especially now, in the North Korean situation. How do you compare actually killing hundreds of thousands, as in Tokyo, or millions, as the Nazis, with risking and threatening and preparing hundreds of millions? Well, I was chewing over that and thinking, I'm not aware that philosophers or theologians or other ethicists have spent much time on that. You know, how do you compare which is worse? Is one comparable to the other at all? And it just occurred to me the other day, the reason for that is the issue did not arise until the mid-50s. It didn't even arise with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because that threatened casualties less than we'd actually already committed in Tokyo and less than the Nazis had done. But the H-bomb and thousands of weapons, and at one point, by the way, we had 37,000 nuclear weapons.
37,000? Wow.
37,000. Let me tell you something. I'm 86 here now, so I remember things historically that you know, a lot of your listeners don't have in their minds exactly. But the following they probably don't even know. In 1952, Truman, the end of the Truman administration, started the election and so forth, we had 1,000 nuclear weapons. They were fission weapons, the kind that North Korea has now. They were bigger, actually, because they tested. They were not H-bombs, they were A-bombs, 1,000. When Eisenhower left office 8 years later, we've now traded a lot of those in now for H-bombs, 1,000 times more powerful. But Eisenhower left Kennedy 23,000 nuclear weapons. And after Kennedy and Johnson, and I served both of those administrations, we had 37,000. And that figure has to be compared, I think, to the following. Herb York, who was the first director of Livermore Nuclear Weapons Labs, working on H-bombs, and later the head of research and engineering for the Defense Department under Eisenhower. He once said at Livermore, how many survivable weapons do you need to deter nuclear attack? Something, you know, that everybody has accepted as very legitimate. How many do you need to deter the kind of opponent who's rational enough to be deterred by such a threat? And he said, it seems to me one, or maybe 10, if you need more. And then from another point of view, he said, what's the maximum, what's the number you need to cause the deaths, the 60 million deaths of World War II? Because he said, one could argue that no one person, no president, no premier, should be able to kill more than World War II in a day or a week. 60 million. He said, well, that's 100. So he said, it seems to me that for deterrence, 100 new thermonuclear weapons, as I said, we had at that point, oh, maybe 12,000 or so thermonuclear, large thermonuclear weapons. Some of the others were smaller tactical weapons, Hiroshima sized. Okay, so one, he said, it takes 1 to 10 to 100 and closer to 1 than 100. Well, that's a pretty strong argument. And that would imply that no state really has any justification for deterrence of nuclear attack to having more weapons than North Korea now has, 10 to 20, maybe enough plutonium for 60. But all the other states have much more than that, and we have 100 times more than that.
Are we worse off now than we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, we're close. Actually, I don't want to say we're worse off and take the kinds of wild comparisons that I've been making, which are really very hard to make. The fact is that at that time we were facing Russia, and there we would have caused the nuclear winter at that point had we ourselves escalated to nuclear war, which was very close to happening. I tell that story in the book, much closer than I knew when I worked for the president in 1962 during the crisis, and much more than anyone knew for decades after that. We were very close. Now, well, again, you're looking at risks, as we were in Cuban Missile Crisis, but it's not really, we're not fighting Russia at this point, unless there's a false alarm, as you pointed out earlier. But really what I came to thinking of the other day, you can't really compare these things. They're both catastrophic. They're both evil. It's not necessary. It's not really possible to say which one is actually worse. Let's say that the risk now is higher than it was then, and it was all too high then. But it's a risk of less than killing 3 billion people, which was the population then, which might have happened, and we wouldn't be here. But let's say that the actual effect will be smaller. It won't be billions, it will be millions.
Stay with us, Daniel. We're at a break here. We're going to come back, and we'll get into your phone calls in just a moment. People on hold waiting to chat with you. The Doomsday Machine with Daniel Ellsberg when we come right back. For all of you, if you're in the Los Angeles area, Feb 13th, lunch with me and Dr. Sky. You just heard him talking about the supermoons. But we're going to have a great time. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com with your phone number. They'll get right back to you, and it's filling up. I think there's one table left, lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And welcome back to our final segment with Daniel Ellsberg. His website is ellsberg.net, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Daniel, let's go to the calls. They're lining up for you. Thomas in La Jolla, California. Go ahead, Thomas.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. Daniel, it's an honor and a privilege to speak to you. I was a young man when the Pentagon Papers were released. And
I think we all were, Tom.
I know. It seems like yesterday, but then I was reflecting, that was like 47 years. Where did the time go? Anyway,
I wasn't so young then. I was 40 then, but I'm 86 now.
Yeah. You know,
not everybody was young then, but okay, go ahead. Thank you.
No problem. Daniel, you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was very public. I mean, we all watched it on the news. But there are other crises. You mentioned India, Pakistan. Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, researched the 1990 incident between Pakistan and India, in which Pakistan was going to launch a first strike, nuclear first strike on India, taking out at least six cities in India. And the United States government under George Bush Sr. found out about it at the last second and got on the hotline with Israel and with Russia. And they really had to put a lot of pressure on Pakistan not to launch. And we didn't find out about it publicly until 3 years later when Seymour Hersh wrote about it extensively in The New Yorker and interviewed people in the State Department and the Department of Defense. One person in the State Department who had been present at the Cuban Missile Crisis said the Pakistan-India incident of 1990 was way worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis because it could have precipitated a all-out nuclear planetary war. And then other people like Peter Pry, interviewed on Coast to Coast, have documented many nuclear brink incidents where we almost went to war. And so I think the real danger is that we've been to the nuclear brink, but it hasn't been public. It's below the radar, so to speak. And I was wondering if you have contemplated that or, you know, many incidents, say, over the last 35 years in which we've almost gone to war, but it's never been reported like the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, very much so, and that's a very good point and not very often made. I have researched this for over 40 years now, since I worked on the plans myself more 50 years ago. And I was saying to my wife, Patricia, just the other day, you know, if I didn't know any more than the public did about how close we've come to war and how large that war would actually be, I wouldn't be concerned. If I didn't know more than the public did, and I said this has all been secret, I wouldn't be thinking about it. I wouldn't be worrying about it. And that's true of most people until, I must say, Donald Trump has awakened them a little suddenly, just as like that false alarm did in Hawaii the other day. And they are taking the possibility more seriously all of a sudden. But you're absolutely right. It so happens that I have been aware of this stuff, in particular, the scale of a disaster on the scale of hundreds of millions. Although it wasn't until 1983 that anyone had really envisioned that the smoke, more than the radioactivity, would go around the world and annihilate the southern hemisphere as well, nearly all humans. And that was in 83. That was doubted for a while by some scientists, just as the connection between smoking and cancer was doubted, and just as some people, not scientists, managed to doubt man-made climate change right now. Well, I'm saying that the public is in a state of unawareness and ignorance about this. And you're right, by the way, in addition to the case you mentioned that Cy Hersh investigated, there was another crisis between India and Pakistan again in 1999, 9 years later, and again came very close to coming out. And again, just not to exaggerate any of this, an India-Pakistan war, according to scientists in the last 10 years, Alan Roebuck, Eric Thune, and others have written peer-reviewed studies of this scientifically, they wouldn't cause near extinction like a U.S.-Russia war. It wouldn't be planetary, George. It would be 2 billion people, a third of the Earth's population, just between India and Pakistan. And by the way, if there was an India, a U.S.-North Korea war, North Korea will cease to exist. Millions of people will be dead. But the further results of that will be, I think, that testing will start again, and India and Pakistan will get thermonuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I was making that distinction earlier. They have A bombs now. They will have H bombs within 1, 2, or 3 years. And at that point, another war between India and Pakistan, and they are making threats this month and last month on that subject, then it would kill three-thirds, not a third of the U.S. population, but they would have their own doomsday machine, such as we have. So another reason is it is essential, and that's what for the public to become aware, I think, of what they've been sleeping on for a long time, what's been kept from them, and that's what my book is addressed to doing. So I might say, by the way, to that listener, I thank you for what you said, but I'm sure you'll be interested. You're already well researched on this subject. You'll find my book very interesting.
Steve in Seattle, Washington, first-time caller. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, you know, we're in a culture of death anyway, and the people don't understand. We've killed 60 million babies in abortions, and they don't think anything of it. We're trying to end it, and it's getting better, but it's still, if they wanted to drop an A-bomb, they wouldn't even think about anything about it. They just do it. It's not right.
Well, the important thing about whoever drops one, they're going to get one dropped back on them, and I'm not sure they're suicidal. What do you think, Daniel?
Well, I think that's certainly true of Korea, and like others. Kim Jong-un is being described as unbalanced and crazy. People who know North Korea, of which I'm not one, but when I read this, they say, no, he's not crazy in that way. He wants to stay alive. He wants his regime, above all, to survive, and that will not happen if there's a war. But he's crazy in a way that all the nine nuclear states are, in a way. Certainly we have been, and that's this. He believes striking first for him would be bad. Actually, it would be annihilating. But in some sense, it would be better than striking second. Now, that's not true in the era of nuclear weapons, but above all, of nuclear winter, of the possibility of smoke and so forth. Striking first is not better than striking second. In a large way, everybody dies. In our case, we wouldn't all die from North Korea. They would. But the world would get even more dangerous than it is now, and millions of people would die. And if it's only, quote, only millions, that's a thousandth of what a U.S.-Russian war would be. But it's more violence than the world has ever seen, the human species has ever seen in a day or a week. And it's very ominous that a quite conservative, even hawkish, expert on Korea, Victor Cho, seems to have been dropped in the last week from consideration of the U.S. ambassador, Trump's ambassador to South Korea, for which he was the leading candidate, apparently dropped because he had said that an attack on North Korea would be disastrous.
Of course.
Against that. Of course. Now, the fact that he's dropped for that reason, and that's what's stated in news stories and an op-ed in the Washington Post just in the last few days, is very disturbing because it implies that they don't want anybody in the administration who isn't ready to start that war. I think unless we tell Congress and tell the public and tell the president that that is not the answer. That was, by the way, his message, that war is not a solution. In fact, of all people, and I don't usually quote him, Stephen Bannon was saying before he was fired, there is no military solution to the problem in North Korea. Well, that's true, but he was fired for that. That's frightening.
Let's go to Walter in Pennsylvania. Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. As usual, it's great to be on with you once again, sir.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Why, with deference to Mr. Ellsberg, I'd just like to say that, as George knows, I'm an arch conservative. I'm a 40-year lifetime member of the National Rifle Association. And Mr. Ellsberg, with all due respect, I think it's obvious that you voted for Hillary, or as I like to call her, Hitlery Clinton. So I'd just like
It's a free country. You're free to call her whatever you want, actually. That's the First Amendment.
I'd just like to say that
in 19... I think that's pretty foolish, but that's my own opinion. I'm free to say that. Go ahead.
Well, In 1953, there were two benevolent New York City pacifists named Julius and Ethel Rosenberg who were hauled up the Hudson River to Sing Sing prison and roasted alive in the electric chair for doing 0.1% the treasonous activity that Bill and Hillary Clinton engaged in. So, Mr. Ellsberg, I would like your opinion on that.
Well, I would say that's a very foolish judgment. I don't think it makes any sense at all. But as I say, it's a free country. You're entitled to that opinion.
And you're used to this.
I disagree with it, certainly. By the way, it so happens, you know, no one in this country is compelled to tell how they vote. It so happens that I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. I wrote in Bernie Sanders in the California because it really didn't matter in this case. I've been urging people in swing states to vote against Donald Trump by voting for Hillary, even if they had reservations about Hillary. And by the way, let me agree with you on one point. I do think there's a lot of basis for reservations about Hillary Clinton. I was very worried, very specifically, that in her talk of a no-fly zone in Syria, that she was proposing an approach that would not actually save lives in Syria, but would lead us into armed conflict with Russia, with Russian planes. And I have to say, as former Marine and somebody who worked on war plans, I don't want, and any communist, from start to finish, I always thought of communist Russia as a tyranny. And nevertheless, I don't want war, armed conflict with Russia, because that does risk the ending of the human, what do you want to call it, experiment, but anyway, species.
It's gone.
The extinction of the species. I want it to go on with all the flaws that humans have and everything else. I would like it to go on, and a war with Russia ends it.
Daniel, do your models predict some kind of nuclear war?
I never had a model of such things. In fact, contrary to people's a lot of conceptions, RAND didn't go in for models. Well, they did a lot of modeling, but a model that would predict a nuclear war, no. My worry about nuclear war is not based on models. It's based on the knowledge when I was in the government and later from studying it of how close we've come so many times. If many people think that because nuclear war is so obviously destructive, that it really can't happen, that the kind of people who get to power, even in Russia or in other places, in India, Pakistan, and so forth, wouldn't be so crazy as to get into a conflict that would escalate to a nuclear war. What I've learned in 86, and from being in a war in Vietnam, from having been shot at by communists, as a matter of fact, it's another story. I tell that story in Secrets, my former book. But anyway, I've been in that situation, and I'm afraid that humans are crazy enough to do that, even if in other respects they're very rational, normal people, and yet wars have occurred. To think that World War I occurred because somehow their diplomats and their leaders were more foolish and more stupid than ours are now, we've grown up somehow, that's not the way it is, in my opinion. Very smart people, all human. I think to be human is to be capable of being very foolish. And you see a lot of that. I don't accept myself from that rule. I think I foolishly participated in the war in Vietnam. I foolishly worked on war plans that were totally unrealistic, and even my version of them would have been catastrophic at the time. So I've certainly been wrong in the past, and I'm sure at 86 that hasn't ended at any particular point. I can only say what I think now.
Knowing
I'm
what you know
about the possibility of nuclear war is based on what I've seen in the last 60 years or so.
And what percent do you think that is possible?
Well, actually, it so happens, it's funny you ask that, because I wrote a PhD thesis at Harvard on subjective probability. and the whether it made sense in all cases to reflect one's uncertainty in terms of the probability. And I concluded not, but there were uncertainties that were greater that could be captured by a single probability. Something closer to that would be kind of a range. I think, for example, right now, that that under Trump right now, I have to say there's at least a 50% chance, but I would say larger.
That's not a good percent. Daniel, we're out of time. The name of the book, The Doomsday Machine. It's always good talking to you. Daniel Ellsberg, we will be back with more on Coast to Coast AM.